Hello and welcome to Our Future in Space. Have you ever wondered what lies beyond Moore's Law? That phenomenon that's been happening since the 1960s, where the number of transistors doubles on a computer chip about every 2 years. We'll be looking at the implications for space computing in particular in our conversation today with Paul Sires from the Department of Energy. I'm Jeff Greenblatt, the Vice President for Science and Research at Orbital Assembly.
And I'm Eric Ward. I'm the VP of Engineering Design at Orbital Assembly. Thanks for joining us, everyone. We think you'll really like this episode.
Our Future in Space, brought to you by Orbital Assembly, with your hosts, Dr. Jeff Greenblatt and Eric Ward.
We're joined today by Dr. Paul Sires. He's a technology manager at the Advanced Materials and Manufacturing Technologies Office at the Department of Energy. His focus areas include energy storage, microelectronics, and technology commercialization. He received a PhD in physics in 2015, and since then has been active in science and technology policy and R&D management. Paul, welcome to Our Future in Space.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you here.
It's our pleasure, yeah. So tell us what you focus on in your role at the Department of Energy.
Yes, within the Advanced Materials and Manufacturing Technologies Office, we are in the part of the Department of Energy that focuses on energy efficiency and renewable energies. So our whole mission is seeding innovation and R&D progress to improve the efficiency and competitiveness of American manufacturers so that they can make their products better and more efficiently, as well as make better and more efficient products.
Okay. And you have a specialty in sort of information technology, data centers, data trends. I mean, these are some of the things that we're certainly very curious about, especially as it pertains to moving out into space. You want to tell us sort of what you've been investigating the last few years?
Yeah. One of my areas of focus is microelectronics and communication technologies. And so we've been looking at the rising energy demand trends for microelectronics technologies, which is intimately coupled with data, the growth of data generation, transmission, and sort of computation. And looking at those trends, there's a really acute need for pioneering further advances in energy efficiency of microelectronic systems, all the way from the fundamental devices through the hardware and systems through the software that is built on those systems.
Okay.
Fascinating. So tell us a little bit about at least some of the short-term or near-term trends that you guys are seeing in terms of the computation and energy consumption in data centers and generally.
Yeah. Up until very recent years, there was about a decade or a few years where the energy use of data centers seemed to be plateauing because there was some really great advancement in terms of efficiencies of running the facilities themselves. But as anyone who's had to switch to, you know, remote work, or anyone who has a Netflix or other streaming service, sorry, I don't want to plug any particular company, anybody who has a streaming service account can probably understand the amount of data that has been, the amount of audio and video data that is now communicated across the globe has really continued to accelerate. The demands on data centers for holding and then transferring all of that data is really, really growing. That's just one sector. In many, many different sectors, we are seeing significant growth in artificial intelligence, which is very exciting. Everybody really loves the capabilities and new things, new performance that artificial intelligence can bring. However, looking across many of the major AI projects, artificial intelligence algorithms, energy use, is on track doubling every 2 months. In another area, Bitcoin mining, as people are probably familiar with, that's been doubling every year for the past few years. Looking farther to the forward, farther to the future, as people are thinking about autonomous driving, smart cities, smart manufacturing, that's that's the next mountain of data and sort of electronic energy use that is coming. And so with all of the hardware that is expected to be required for that, sensors and systems and all, as well as all the data that those are expected to generate and transmit, machine-to-machine communication, IoT data, is expected to completely dwarf the already gargantuan amounts of data that we communicate every day today.
Okay, can you give us a definition of machine-to-machine or IoT data? I'm not sure everybody listening knows what that means exactly.
Orbital Assembly is leading the way in the development of artificial gravity stations so people can live, work, and thrive in space.
OAC's platforms are market category creators. They are backwards compatible with current standards, allowing for you to move from concept to production at the pace of business.
To learn more, visit orbitalassembly.com.
Sure. It is data that is created and transmitted, and most of the life and use of that data really isn't ever seen by a human. A human is not in that loop. It is data that is generated by some sensor, and then transmitted and automatically sort of processed by an automated system. It can be anywhere from sensor systems to just different pieces of a larger complex automated system checking in and sort of communicating status results with each other.
Sure. So
it might seem that,
I was gonna say, like, when you mentioned that, like, my mind goes to like an industrial factory maybe that has some hundreds of sensors monitoring different pressures and material feedstocks and speeds and that sort of thing. And then that all goes to a control system that sort of monitors and checks itself and tells the machines what to do, but they're just not necessarily human. They're, you know, pressing buttons or looking at that data. It's sort of an entirely automated system, maybe with a human sort of looking at sort of an aggregate dashboard of what's going on. Is that the kind of system we're talking about?
That's exactly right. That's one example, and that's exactly right. It can be anywhere from something that is mostly automated or even to something that does have a GUI interface with someone sort of monitoring the overall process. But the integrated picture they see is built upon a mountain of data that is coming in from the sensors and routers and various control systems.
The human just never interacts with that data at that level, just okay.
Exactly. It's seamless, and it allows all of the very complex, wonderful things that we can do and are trying to develop to be able to do. But it is data, and it requires energy to make it, it requires energy to transmit it, and it requires energy to sort of process it and come up with the useful information.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, okay. So I think one question that we have is, let's maybe talk a little bit about the energy of all of this data. But perhaps before we get into that question, if you could break down for us the difference between, you know, doing something with the data or what we normally think of as computation versus just the mere storage and sort of movement of data across a network. I mean, what is sort of the lion's share of the energy use, and what do you most care about, or maybe all three of these are important from a planning point of view?
We do care about all three, but the lion's share of the data use is the movement of the data. The computational systems we have right now are built upon an electron and moving an electron to represent a byte of information, a bit of information. So, electron.
Excuse me. Electrons. You mean that the lion's share of energy consumption is the transmission of that data?
That is correct. Yes. Yeah. And that in the most basic sense of imagining this future with thousands of sensors in many different places, be that for a smart office where the lights know where the lights and HVAC systems know which rooms people are in and know when those people leave those rooms, and maybe even to the point of knowing what level of comfort that each individual likes it, to a smart manufacturing plant where all of the lines are sort of definitely continuously monitored autonomously, and even to some extent sort of controlled autonomously. In this future, most of these sensors, the individual sensor nodes, are going to be wireless. It's just think of the pain that it would be to individually wire up every single sensor with both power and communication lines. So Right. To transmit data wirelessly is a pretty significant energy, has a pretty significant energy demand. Or even if, even in this scenario where everything is wired, say by fiber optics, that also requires energy to transmit. And it requires energy per distance to transmit. Sure. And so these things are quite spread out. Even down on a laptop, in the motherboard, the centimeters of distance that are required to transmit the data from the memory chip to the computing chip are not nothing. They are significant amounts that stack up, especially when you start to go into machine learning and artificial intelligence. Those methods of computing, those approaches to computing are highly parallel. And in today's microelectronics technologies, the central processing unit, the CPU, is really built to do things one step at a time, not in parallel. And so in the areas of generating sensor data and then moving it to, say, the cloud or even just like a local central computing site, that the more data you generate and move, the more energy you need to do all of that. Mm. And then as we're using more and more artificial intelligence or machine learning based analysis approaches, they do not run well with central processing units. Sure. So they are, the central processing unit is one of the worst approaches to run AI software, for example, because you take what is supposed to be a parallel approach, and then you would essentially be chopping it up into the individual chunks and then just feeding them one by one slowly, which involves a tremendous amount of moving data to the CPU and then back, and then moving it to the CPU and then back. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just highlighting a lot of areas that are challenges today. The exciting thing is thinking about overcoming those challenges tomorrow, because there are already so many bright researchers and individuals working on solutions to these challenges. And one of the things that really excites me in my job, one of the particular things that we've started working on, is we just recently sort of kicked off an effort to really get the entire semiconductor industry sort of to collaborate, to communicate with each other, and to develop a specific roadmap for planning and developing and rolling out new technologies that can provide energy efficiency improvements to double the energy efficiency of microelectronic systems every 2 years for the next two decades. And for anybody tuning in who's familiar with sort of the microelectronics industry and familiar with Moore's Law, we're kind of modeling this on Moore's Law, which said that every 2 years, the number of transistors on a chip would double, which gave us the over 50 years of technology improvement in microelectronics that we've had. We're setting a similarly lofty goal to double the energy efficiency every 2 years for the next two decades. One thing that really was able, if you have a question, I'll let you interject. I've been going on.
Well, actually, I was going to say, I just need to take a short break to run one of our sponsor videos, and we'll continue this conversation in a few seconds. Stand by.
Ideas are powerful things. Ideas drive us to broaden our minds and help us seek truth about the universe around us. We are Rogue Space Systems. Ideas above.
Okay. So yes, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to make that interruption. So you weren't quite.
I want to know more. So,
sure.
You know,
absolutely.
Yeah. Like what kind of timeframes are you looking here? You know, how long before you think we can kind of get started down this path of doubling energy efficient every 2 years? And what kind of time horizon are you looking out to try to set up systems to continue this going for how long?
Oh, certainly. So the good news is there are already innovations that can provide us those energy efficiency gains even in the near term. What we're really hoping to catalyze and to build is this longer term roadmap that can continue to give us regular innovations every 2 years, not just 4 years from now, not just 6 years from now, but in a decade, in 16 years, in 20 years, and build on the momentum to hopefully be able to continue that even farther out to 30 years, maybe 40 mm-hmm. years. When you look at the cumulative effect, I believe we will get 10,000x improvement mm-hmm. in the next 10 or 100,000x improvement doing it for the next 20 years. One thing that that Moore's law really had going for it, one thing that they were able to leverage was the semiconductor industry did do this in the past with Moore's law. They created the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors, ITRS, which really was all of the different the chip designers, the materials designers, the manufacturers, and all many different aspects of the supply chain got together and built out a technology roadmap talking about, you know, okay, in order to hit this next goal in 4 years, what technologies do we think can help us achieve that? Where are they in the development process? What is needed? Who needs to coordinate with who in terms of to develop those and mm-hmm. continue to hit those milestones? They had a good thing that they could leverage for most of Moore's law is a driving perspective that making the transistor smaller makes it better in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. For decades, making it smaller mm-hmm. allowed you to switch and run the transistor faster. It allowed mm-hmm. it caused it to have actually a longer lifetime. It made it more energy efficient. There are a lot of technical details as to why, but the result was they could really orient the development focus on making transistors smaller and how to make them in higher volumes and cheaper. Unfortunately, the gains, the benefits of that have run out. Mm-hmm. They are essentially running out. We, from just looking at physics, looking at the dimensions of the atomic spacing between two silicon atoms, we're about mm-hmm. to hit, we're hitting sort of those limits. And there are some ideas in terms of maybe being able to use different materials and mm-hmm. sort of tweak things and push them, but we're really pushing up against the limit of that.
I was just saying for energy efficiency, maybe we're just about to answer this. You know, you mentioned for the past 50 years with Moore's law, a lot of that's been driven by smaller transistors. Well, what are the levers that we have to pull to improve energy efficiency? What different things can we do in computer and chip design that can get us towards doubling our energy efficient on a regular basis?
Oh yeah, certainly. I was actually just
probably about to say that. Yeah.
to dive into that, mm-hmm. which is unfortunately there's not a single direction or a single sort of driving mm-hmm. Innovation idea that can give us such regular efficiency gains. It's almost the inverse of that. While the first, you know, 60 to 70 years of driving the industry was based on a single principle of scaling things down, making them smaller, the future of innovation in the semiconductor industry more broadly, as well as for energy efficiency specifically, is going to be that different improvements are going to come from wildly different areas. There are some researchers who are working on transistors that use a different physical phenomenon to switch and to turn on and off, to transmit sort of the signal of yes, or to switch between on and off, or yes or no. One example is called tunneling transistors. They use the quantum mechanical effect of tunneling through barriers to sort of control and operate at much, much lower voltages, which needs much less power. Others are using devices that we already have in different ways. There are a lot of really exciting efforts around what's called memory in compute or compute in memory. Some of the efforts are calling themselves one thing and the others, but it's based on the same idea of you can use the same sort of groupings of transistors not only to do the algorithmic computation, but you can also save the data in that same physical space, which
like gets rid of those transport energy costs that you were talking about from the memory to the processor back to the memory.
Exactly.
If it's all in one place. Yeah,
exactly. And that type of computing is perfect, is really well suited for AI and machine learning, because then you can build hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of parallel computing nodes, sure, where the memory is right there, and you can just flow the data and the computation through them all at once.
Right, which might not make my laptop faster on a daily basis, but yeah, for these very specific and high energy consumption applications like AI and machine learning, you could have a specifically designed chip that was very efficient at that.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And I was just going to bring up, Paul, what we've talked about before is this trend that I don't think that the listeners are generally aware of, toward away from a general purpose processor, mm-hmm, like our traditional CPU, right? The brain of the computer executing a single linear set of instructions, and toward these specialized architectures that are designed for, in some cases, a single purpose, right? Like an AI algorithm, not even all AI algorithms, but one in particular. Can you talk a little bit more about what's been happening in that area and why there's so much promise there?
Oh, yes. So there's been a lot. We already actually are seeing it in the latest generations of cell phones, and as well as Google has their own data centers, which uses specialized chips. And then cell phones are now built incorporating specialized, what they call accelerators. Those are just specialized chips for specific sets of functions. This central processing unit was always built up as a handle-everything kind of chip. It could do just about any type of computation. And the way that you do that is building up more and more layers of more and more sophisticated software on top of it to tell it to do very different things. If you're not interested in a chip that can do anything, if you know that you just have a very specific set of types of computations that you would like to do, you can design the physical circuitry of that chip in a much more optimized way. And the resulting chip will not only perform better, perform faster, it will be much more efficient. The efficiency gains that you can get from specializing the hardware to specific computational applications ranges from 100x energy efficiency improvement all the way up to this 10,000, 100,000x. This isn't a silver bullet, though, because specially designing those chips is a more time and effort intensive process. It takes more people doing a lot more thinking of how to optimize those designs, as well as it is very specific. It is for very specific sets of computations or very specific applications. So while we might not be able to replace a laptop with a set of all super optimized chips, at least some of the computations we know our laptop is going to be doing a lot of, we can replace those. And then for those computations that are done, those specific activities will be sped up a lot faster. This is a particular help when we're actually thinking about the smart cities and the smart manufacturing places of the future, because what are these sensor nodes doing? They're doing the same data generation, collection, and sort of computation over and over and over. Yeah, right. So in a specific application area, chip specialization and circuit specialization is really, really useful getting major energy efficiency gains. And what that does is you could not only generate the data at the sensor node, you can also do some computation there. Mm-hmm. And so then you don't have to send every bit of sensor data off of that sensor node. You can do a lot of your computation so that you're only sending 1/10 or 1/100 of the data to whatever more centralized database or
sure. Well, that's something that, you know, Jeff and I have been thinking a lot about in terms of space and spaceflight, right? We have a lot of satellites. Let's pick Earth observation, for example, right? Looking down at the planet, collecting images or, you know, multispectral data or whatnot. And that data, there's a, you know, a lot of data being generated, but there are bandwidth constraints of getting that data down to the Earth. And so what you're talking about is, you know, this edge computing where that, you know, maybe that satellite is doing all the data reduction and kind of figuring out what the insights are and just sending those insights back. Mm-hmm. But taking that even a step further, you're saying that if we start designing these application specific, you know, processors for these specific satellites, then they could even become more, you know, energy and speed efficient in order to do that kind of edge computing.
Yes.
So do you think that this type of edge computing will show us, you know, benefits in other areas in kind of global computing in a way? And
I hope so. There are some right now there are many proponents of cloud computing, sending everything and having it done and having it computed centrally in a database. Mm-hmm. But when you really look at the math, at the numbers of data that is expected to be generated for certain processes or for certain applications, sending all of that just becomes untenable. Mm-hmm. And so edge computing is, I think, cloud computing is having a heyday right now. It's very useful for many things, but as mm-hmm. things continue to grow, I think we will see a shift to more, once again, back towards more localized computing, even in the case of sort of edge computing, mm-hmm. doing more and more computing literally on site. In the case mm-hmm. of automated driving, that's a perfect sort of mm-hmm. larger example of it, because recent estimates, this was a little while ago, I can't remember exactly how long ago I read it, but 4 to 5 terabytes of data are generated every hour from like these current wow. sort of pilot self-driving car trips. I mean, can you expecting all of that to be transmitted to some central server, and then adding on top of that the quick reaction times that will be needed for cars mm-hmm. to assess, identify a potential danger or safety risk ahead and make a decision and act in that time.
Right.
Even when the network's yeah. running, that's a tall order. And then you have to think about yeah. like, what if there are technology glitches?
Sure. My brain goes to an O'Neill cylinder out in the orbit of Ceres. We talked about that in a previous podcast. And, you know, you certainly can't have a self-driving car there trying to process yes. its decisions on a data center on Earth, you know, or something. So,
and that's just talking about terrestrial distances. If you mm-hmm, then right. extend that into space, the distances become much larger. Yeah. Additionally, just the harsh environment of space is going to extremely restrict, at least in my opinion, it's going to extremely restrict where humans can go and what humans can do actually in space. So to really maximize what we as a society, what an industry or an economy can do in space, automation is key.
Yeah.
What more things can we automate? And then along with automation is the data generation and the data processing. And so I think trends will really push it towards edge computing in space, not just between, you know, data gathered in space and sent down to the Earth, mm-hmm. but also mm-hmm. Data gathered in one part of a station or on one yeah. station yeah. before it's sent to another station for automation and coordination activities. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. And really, that.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Sorry. And the reason for that is mainly because you're trying to distribute your workload, keep as many bits sort of on the initial sensor or the initial platform as possible, so that what you're transmitting is as low bandwidth as possible. Or are there other reasons why you want to have this kind of distribution of capability in space?
Oh, certainly. And there's going to be a lot of work done by the scientists and the engineers developing specific processes and specific systems in asking those questions. What data and what activities are really, really important and needed to be sort of kept locally? And what is the absolute, what is the minimum that you do need to transmit to a central location or to communicate with a partner piece of equipment or partner station, really being able to parse out what is absolutely necessary to transmit out mm-hmm. and what can we fully localize.
Yeah. So Paul, I was wondering, we had talked about some of these other trends, and I wanted you to kind of talk about some of them, but what really piqued my interest was you mentioning adiabatic computing. And I know what adiabatic means, but I have no idea what adiabatic computing would mean when you stuff those two words together. So yeah, why don't we start there?
Oh, sure. Yeah, this is one of the more really out there ideas, which is really exciting for sort of a scientist like me to think about. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we can get it realized sometime in the future. Adiabatic is really it's a much more technical term for reversible computing. where you can do a computational process and flow the data one way, but then you can relax it and flow it the other way. And just an inherent thing about sort of adiabatic or reversible processes is they require far less energy. They're just fundamentally much more energy efficient than irreversible processes.
Sure. So how would you use a process like that in computing?
That is a good question. I'm less familiar with the details of exact applications, but sure. There are a few different approaches to adiabatic computing, a few different fundamental ideas of how it's accomplished, but. But it really is, again, trying to answer the question of how can we fundamentally compute things, process information and change data in ways so that we can go from something that we don't know to sort of realizing new information and new knowledge, and just looking at it from systems, how can we make that more energy efficient?
That's interesting. So we might not have the actual design of a transistor that could do that. But the idea is that, we know as scientists that adiabatic processes exist. We know that they're more energy efficient than similar irreversible processes. And so the idea is, what can we do as a research and development community to yes. leverage that type of science to make more
energy. And I do know that we are as far as proposals of the actual physical systems that would do this adiabatic computing. One of the things that I love about the place in technology development where I work is it is in our sweet spot is the space in between when an individual researcher at a national lab or a university or even sort of an exploratory, team at a company makes an initial discovery or has an idea for a brand new thing that has sort of never brand new product or device that has never existed before. The difference between figuring out if you can do it at all or doing it the first time, the difference between that and being able to say, yes, you would like 1,000 of those next week. We can get those for you at this price. That is a massive gulf. And just saying Valley of Death really does not give justice to all the work and all the ingenuity that goes into that. And so we try and find those things that are on the earlier side and really give them the support to be able to make it to the other side. Mm-hmm. So adiabatic computing still very much in the early side, but people have done some really great thinking about it. The question is how do we go about realizing the materials and the manufacturing processes so that we can make them in ways that they will work?
That someone could order 1,000 of them next week. Yeah.
Yes.
So we had a question from one of the listeners wondering about quantum computing. Is that going to change the energy efficiency? Is that going to change the rate at which we'll be able to improve our computing power or efficiency? Or, what kind of trends would that have in computing?
Yes, we do believe that will definitely be able to have some impacts in lowering the overall energy demand of computing sort of globally or across the board. Quantum computing can be very efficient and very fast at specific applications. So that really actually is another great example of why we are trying to put together this overall roadmap, bring the whole industry together, because for some problem areas, quantum computing is the solution. For other problem areas, just maybe even photonic data transmission at the chip level is the answer. For some areas, these application-specific integrated circuits or ASICs, are the is the solution. And very often it's probably going to be, combinations of many of those. One of the really exciting pieces to this whole roadmap that we're hoping to sort of flesh out the details of is what's called advanced packaging. Sounds kind of boring, but what it really boils down to is traditionally everything's been built on silicon wafers using the same manufacturing processes for making the same transistors and the same connections between them on silicon wafers, lithography, and everything. Many of these new exciting technologies that are much more energy efficient, especially on the hardware side, they're not made the same way, or they're made with lithography, but they're not made on silicon, or you can't, you know, make one with the exact same process. So how can you, but again, each of these pieces isn't intended to replace traditional silicon-based computers.
That kind of gets back to your earlier point where, you know, for 50 years, we've kind of had this one path of getting better computing, but now we're going to have to be really looking at these very different new technologies that all have very different applications. And, you know, it sounds like maybe my laptop will still be this sort of traditional silicon general processing unit, but as we grow into these more specialized areas of computing, they will require more specialized types of hardware to really be efficient.
Yeah. And so the advanced packaging is looking at ways of being able to make each of the optimized pieces and combine them in a way in ways that they will work. Right now, you combine the different chips on a motherboard. It's quite large. And advanced packaging would be a way to really do it to pack things in much more tightly. You greatly decrease the distances that you have to transmit that data that we were talking about at the beginning. And you can also probably open up many, many more channels of communication between one subsystem or one chip and another chip.
Boy, that sounds like something that would be especially useful in the constrained mass and energy environment of space computing.
You know. Oh, certainly. And I mean, another thing about space that I think probably maybe the layperson doesn't realize is how harsh of an environment it is out there and how much radiation there is. You know, we enjoy a whole lot from our atmosphere in terms of protection from radiation.
The magnetic field of Earth and the atmosphere protect us both from very different but important kinds of radiation. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of people already know, but radiation is very difficult for computers to deal with. You know, really quick, you want to give our listeners a primer on why radiation is a problem for a computer chip?
Oh, certainly. I mean, if you think about it, the size that transistors have gotten now, they are a few nanometers in width and maybe 20 or 30, you know, also only a few nanometers in length. That's not that many atoms. And those atoms have to be precisely sort of like engineered. Radiation can come in, radiation either in the form of a really, really high energy sort of ion or neutron can come in and just really wreck, just blow defects in things. And so you'll have a transistor that's working and then it'll get hit by either sort of a higher energy particle or even just gamma radiation, just really high energy that causes changes in the chemical bonds and just sort of creates a defect that kills that individual transistor. Some of those transistors, they might be memory bits that are unused. They might be something that's not very important. Others, it might be that bit, part of that bit of data that is held that sort of ties the whole system together or various things like that. And it's not just a single hit of radiation. That's really the big thing is that when we move out to space, we're going to orders of magnitude more radiation. So your chip is just being bombarded thousands. So you're getting thousands of defects or various things like that if you don't protect it properly and if you don't take the right steps.
Yeah, there's a lot of additional mass and space used up for radiation shielding and additional extra processors, right, to have redundancy, and things like that to be able to, you know, account for those losses in that difficult environment. So Jeff, did you have a question?
I was kind of preempting. I was just going to tie back to the conversation we were having a few minutes ago about edge computing in space. And I was just curious, Paul, if you could tell us sort of what are some special challenges of doing, you know, all of this on spacecraft computing in orbit in this high radiation environment with perhaps limited space and limited power compared to doing edge computing on Earth, if there's just any, you know, highlights you might want to share about what makes that challenging.
Kind of a different situation. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really do think one of the main things, it depends on whether first off, you could get a significant amount of the radiation shielding just by the shielding that would be on the station. So you're shielding both humans and your computational technology at the same time, but that only goes so far. As we've already seen, actually car companies and the chip manufacturers for car companies have had to adjust their designs and their manufacturing processes because a few years ago, they were starting to see impacts of radiation on the chips in cars, wreaking real havoc in their ability to drive and ability to function properly. Just the shielding for humans might not necessarily be enough. And that's also only taking into account whatever computing you would want to have inside the station. Mm-hmm. If it might make sense to place the computational resource to save space for the humans, it might make sense to place it outside of the station, in which case you would have to then consider the radiation shielding separately. Another thing to, of course, a lot of the problems you'd want, you share similar perspectives to trying to protect humans in space, mm-hmm. Not just with the radiation, but also the extreme temperature swings. It is extremely cold in space when you're not getting light sunlight, shone on you from the sun. And then it's the opposite. When light is shining on you, it really can heat up materials very, very quickly.
Yep, there's no wind to blow the heat away from a surface. Yeah. You know, you only have...
And these are also... cooling and... I mean, data centers, and it might be a good time to speak to this, data centers are very energy-dense systems. That is, even on Earth, you have so much power being utilized in a small area that active cooling is really, really important to keep them functioning. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine how much more challenging it will be, as Eric said, where you don't have convection to take the heat away in space, right?
Yes. Yes. And again, being able to hopefully, the design constraints are going to be much, much more difficult. Depending on the opportunities, depending on what industries move up to space, on the one hand, thinking about having to ship all of the chips and all of the containment materials fully formed and already created up into orbit, versus if there's some way that manufacturing capabilities could be put up there beforehand, in which case you can then just send up the raw materials for processing and manufacturing up there. I don't know, you know, which situation, but the different things, the size and weight concerns are would certainly be significant in terms of being able to get everything up there that you need to.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly we've talked with several guests about the possibility of sourcing the raw materials from extraterrestrial locations like the moon or near Earth asteroids, because, you know, silicon is pretty plentiful, you know, in almost all space rocks.
We're very lucky. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. We picked a good element to build our rocks. I mean, we need various dopants, and you can probably tell us more about that than we can. But I think in principle, one could move toward semiconductor manufacturing in orbit from space-based resources in the longer term.
Yeah, and there are some other substrates that perform much better in the harsher environment of space. I believe silicon carbide is one of them that can sort of perform better. So yes, really taking into account, making considerations for the space environment goes all the way across the board, not just the software and the applications that you're building things for, and sort of a lot of software, all the way down to the hardware, all the way down to the materials that the hardware is made of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's another complex system for sure.
Definitely. I was just gonna mention, Paul, as I think you're aware, you know, Orbital Assembly is building an on-orbit manufacturing platform that we hope to attract numerous customers to, so that we can start to see these kinds of manufacturing capabilities happening, you know, where it makes sense. But I think there'll be more and more reasons to be doing manufacturing in orbit to take advantage either of these various mass advantages or just the low gravity environment there.
Some of the conversations we've had when we're talking really far future, you know, we start running up against mass constraints in terms of the input and the raw material, right? Like if you imagine, you know, hundreds of thousands of O'Neill cylinders, you know, all in one place, well, every, you know, time you use a rocket to move from one to another, well, you're letting all those atoms go into space that you can't recover. And you know, eventually you might run out of the atoms to use as rocket fuels. And so people are thinking about ways to get from one O'Neill cylinder to another that doesn't use, you know, a rocket. But, you know, I think in a conversation like this, you know, what about the computers, right? We're seeing these dramatic increases in computational power, this Moore's law, or, you know, even if we go to more and more energy efficient computers, maybe they aren't faster, but that energy efficiency is also still desirable, right? Because that energy has a real cost to it, you know? And so in the world of even the green Moore's law, as you're looking into these, you know, space stations or, you know, other places where you're in a very sort of constrained environment, is there a way to recycle computer processors in a tangible way where you can reuse that silicon rather than having to go out and get more when you want, you know, a decade down the road to have a more energy efficient processor and do that upgrade, if, you know, without needing to bring in all these extra materials? Is there a thought around that?
Yeah, there's ongoing work in trying to increase. So the general term that we give that is called e-waste. So, you know, just electronic waste, and it's a wide ranging in the types of things that sort of fall into that category. Which also means there's going to be a wide range of ways to try and recapture that. So my office is actually, my office and many other offices sort of in the government are funding work to try and not only develop new ways for recycling, repurposing, remanufacturing, microelectronics parts, but also do the important work of scaling it up, making sure that it is scalable and making sure that there is a way that it can be done, that works in our current sort of market driven and sort of works in our current economy and the economy of the future. Because as it's really interesting kind of to think of how much transistors and microelectronics have shrank. That means that the older technology that we're kind of throwing away now has way more useful material than the stuff that we're making now. So being able to recapture that and then reuse it. And so there's a whole, it's interesting. It's a larger version of the old recycling sort of thing of reduce, reuse, recycle. And everybody thinks about recycle, but it's like reduce is very important.
Kind of in that order, reduce how much you use, reuse it if you can, and then recycle it, right?
And in that reuse category, there's many different levels of it. People talk a lot more about this in the battery space in terms of like, okay, a battery is no longer good for using in an electric vehicle, but could you then put it into a system that helps support a building or a grid? You have similar ideas about that in terms of, okay, this chip can no longer run, you know, as quickly or as powerfully for these types of high-end applications. Yeah, but can you use the same chip just for processes that don't have such tight sort of performance requirements? Mm-hmm. And then on down to, okay, well, like maybe let's just pull these pieces out and sort of repurpose or repackage all the way down to, all right, we're going to have to scrap everything, reclaim all the materials, and then, you know, start from scratch.
Yeah, how very interesting. Well, I'd love to talk more, but there's an interesting listener question that I want to squeak in here before we wrap up.
Sure.
Aiden asked, what inspired you to learn about computers and go into this field, and what or who do you see as inspiration?
Oh, that's a really good question. Two different inspirations. There was one that sort of the inspiration to go down into semiconductors and microelectronics. My background is in the physics of materials, and so as a research student back in the day, I was making little crystals and measuring their electromagnetic properties, and so trying to see, okay, what can we use this knowledge for? And a lot of it went into the semiconductor space. And when you then just learning more about the semiconductor industry in general, the fact that we have these giant machines that can pinpoint and move almost individual atoms, we can have atomic precision, and they do it, you know, you know, they create billions of transistors on a chip, and they do that multiple times, you know, an hour and multiple times a day, and create millions of these. And the fact that we can have such precision and such deep, deep scientific knowledge and control of this, and that we can do it so much and just like never ending is great. Mm-hmm. And then on the policy side, the reason why I kind of went into the government and government support of R&D was, The one remaining physicist in Congress came and gave a talk at my university when I was a graduate student, and he kind of finished it up saying there are people who are sort of giants in their field, genius level intellects that are putting a lot of time and effort into research projects that are a few tens of thousands of dollars, a few hundreds of thousands of dollars in size, whereas down the road or somewhere else geographically, you have people that don't have a scientific background making decisions about hundreds of billions of dollars mm-hmm. in research funding. And that it's important to have people from the technical, with those technical backgrounds, being able to participate in the conversations and help inform the decision makers, so that the incredibly important task of sort of, you know, spending this money for progress, that the that good decisions are made.
Oh, wow, that's really inspiring. I really like hearing that was one of your motivations.
It's encouraging. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, we've got to not just think about how we can learn more, but you know, in a way, think about how we can fund it and fund that learning, right? And continue in, you know, on and on in the future to keep that engine of knowledge rolling. So I love it. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us. That's about the time we have today. So I really appreciate it. That was a great conversation. And thank you to everybody who's listening to this live or when it's releases a recording. You know, of course, listeners, like always, if you have any suggestions for topics, people you'd like us to interview, or just want to be part of the conversation, we'd love to get a hold of you in chat. You can find us on Twitter at Our Future Space, on Facebook at Our Future in Space, and of course, email us at ourfutureinspace@orbitalassembly.com. We look forward to hearing from you guys soon.
And if you like what we're doing at Orbital Assembly and would like to learn how you might be able to help us, feel free to reach out to us at info@orbitalassembly.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Paul, for your gracious time today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real fun chat.
Absolutely.
For us as well. All right. Till next time. Take care, all. Bye-bye.
This program represents the personal opinions of the hosts and their guests. The content, opinions, and views do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of Orbital Assembly nor the organizations with which any of the program participants may be affiliated. The mere appearance or promotion of this program does not constitute an endorsement by Orbital Assembly or its affiliates. Our Future in Space. Copyright Orbital Assembly. Hosts Dr. Jeff Greenblatt and Eric Ward. Audio and video production by Tim Alatorre. Musical theme, The Last Day by Dark Blue Studio.